This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 18th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with the author of On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. Plus, a report on recent changes for the nonprofit organization Kendrick Venture Hydration for Life. Ruby Brock has his weekly business and political news recap, the latest installment of Arkansongs, and more. But first, the Arkansas Legislative Council on Friday heard details of the agreement reached between the state and three central Arkansas school districts to end desegregation payments. Litigation involving the Little Rock, North Little Rock, and Pulaski County special school districts and the state of Arkansas first began in the early 80s. The deal would send annual payments of around $65 million to the districts for four more years and includes creating a Jacksonville North Pulaski school district and will randomly assign students in magnet programs. However, not everyone is pleased with the terms of the deal. State Representative John Walker also represents the Joshua Interveners, a group advocating on behalf of black students in the case, and he expressed skepticism that the payments will actually achieve the goal of desegregation and that the issues still aren't addressed even now.
The intended beneficiaries of this case were the children, primarily black children of the district, whose educational interests were not being addressed. Those children still do not have the same educational opportunities and outcomes as the children of the majority race.
Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel emphasized that after more than two decades of ongoing litigation, it was time to end the case for good.
And if we don't have a settlement, my marching orders are to end this money immediately, regardless of the damage it may do. I've never really wanted to do that. I don't think any of you really want me to have to do that.
But the Little Rock School Board must decide on giving its final approval of the settlement with or without support of the Joshua Interveners by midnight Tuesday. Without their support, the case continues in court on December 9th. Officials with the Buffalo National River have released the park's operating plan for the 2014 season. Kevin Clark, public information officer for the Buffalo National River, says among other changes, a few sites are being reopened next year, particularly the launch site at Ponca.
We closed it last year, learned by our mistake. It's going to be open this year. We've changed from the upper Pruitt to lower Pruitt. The restrooms are going to be open there. And we're experimenting at a couple of locations. We're going to leave the restroom facilities open, but we're not going to service them very often during the winter months on the supposition that they're not going to receive very much use. I think one of the big things that visitors are going to experience is an absence of trash and recycling facilities at most of our locations.
Meaning that park officials will be pulling recycling and trash receptacles from various sites. Clark says the move is being made for a couple of reasons.
Number one, to save money, because having that stuff hauled, dealing with it, costs the park a lot of money and a lot of staff time. And we also would really like our visitors to help us out, to give us a hand in the process of taking care of the park and its resources. We'd like our visitors to maybe think before they come, maybe repackage what they're bringing so that when they are done with their visit, they have less stuff, and you know, and try to work with us.
Clark says with declining budgets and increased overhead costs, the Buffalo National River isn't alone, and other national parks are implementing similar belt-tightening measures. Holiday lights are up on the state's capitol, and decorations are being hung on the inside of the building. Renovation work was recently completed on the interior of the capitol's dome, funded by a National Resource Council grant. Guests are invited to see the freshly painted dome as well as the decorations on December 7th for the official holiday lighting ceremony. Spokesman for the Secretary of State, Alex Reed, says there are banners, wreaths, and lights inside.
About 2 weeks ago, they started putting up the exterior lights on the Capitol that will be on all sides of the Capitol. There's about 100,000 lights.
Reed says decorating the Capitol has been a tradition for more than four decades. Visitors can view decorations from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. beginning December 7th. Walmart and the Walmart Foundation are helping support relief efforts in the Philippines following the wake of Typhoon Haiyan. The retail giant and its charitable foundation are committing $1 million to emergency relief efforts in the country. And the retailer has also set up websites for donating to the Red Cross's typhoon relief efforts. The contributions will focus on addressing immediate needs such as food, medical supplies, and health care. Springdale-based Tyson Foods is reporting a record year with its fourth quarter earnings statement this morning. The company posted $8.9 billion in sales on top of $416 million in operating income for the quarter, compared to $8.3 billion in revenue and $354 million of operating income for the same period in 2012. For the year, Tyson posted $34.4 billion in revenue, representing a 4% increase over 2012, while operating income rose about 7% to $1.38 billion in 2013. The Razorback soccer team won its first match ever in the NCAA tournament this weekend. The Razorbacks won 2-1 over Oklahoma State in the first round of the tournament. Arkansas moves on to second round play against St. John's, New York, Friday at Durham, North Carolina. Kickoff is slated for 4 p.m. Central Time. The John Brown University women's soccer team also had a successful weekend. Friday night, the Golden Eagles defeated Oklahoma City in penalty kicks in the Sooner Athletic Conference Tournament Final. With the victory, JBU advances to the NAIA National Championships. It's the first SAC tournament title in the program's history and JBU's second ever automatic berth to the national tournament. The round of 32 is played at various host sites around the country and is scheduled for Saturday. And finally, the Arkansas men's and women's cross-country teams both won NCAA regional titles Friday. All seven runners on the women's team placed in the top 20 to win the NCAA South Central Regional and qualified for the NCAA National Championship. The men's cross-country team finished similarly, with five runners placing in the top 16 to earn all region honors and a spot in the national championship in Terre Haute, Indiana. The national championship will take place this Saturday. Tonight, expect clear skies with lows in the mid to upper 30s. Partly cloudy tomorrow with highs in the upper 50s to lower 60s. And tomorrow night, expect partly cloudy conditions with lows from the upper 30s to the lower 40s. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has income numbers for Walmart, Dillard's, and more in his weekly business and political news recap.
Walmart posted third quarter net income of $3.74 billion. That was up nearly 3% compared to the same quarter 1 year ago. Total revenue topping $115 billion. That was up 1.7%. Same-store sales in the U.S. were down 0.3% in the quarter, and that led Walmart officials to lower their future earnings guidance based on tougher competition and worries about the economy heading into the holiday shopping season. Dillard's grew sales and profits as it heads into the crucial holiday shopping season too. The Little Rock-based upscale retailer posted net income of $50.9 million on revenue of a little over $1.5 billion. 1 year ago, Dillard's reported net income in the third quarter of $48.5 million on revenue of $1.49 billion. Same-store sales for Dillard's during the quarter pushed higher by 1%. Fort Smith-based trucking and transportation firm Arkansas Best posted quarterly net income of nearly $14 million on revenue of more than $623 million. 1 year ago, Arkansas Best showed $6.5 million in profits on revenue of a little over $577 million. On October 30th, the company announced a ratification of a revised labor contract with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, with savings from wage and benefit reductions possibly helping the company to avoid three consecutive years of losses. Little Rock-based international hunger relief organization Heifer International reports that its field staff in the Philippines are all accounted for, and it's working to assess damage to five field projects in the region. Last week, a killer typhoon wreaked havoc on the Asian Pacific island nation. With 230 mile-per-hour winds and storm surges topping 10 feet, the storm may have killed as many as 10,000 in its total path. Baptist Health announced it will begin a long-term lease agreement with Hot Spring County Medical Center in Malvern on January 1st. At that time, the hospital will be named Baptist Health Medical Center Hot Spring County and will become Baptist Health's eighth hospital. Hot Spring County Medical Center is a community-based hospital with approximately 360 employees. It's licensed for 72 acute care beds. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Roby Brock on Ozarks at Large is provided by the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. It's a natural reaction for drivers to tense up when a police car approaches, even if they aren't doing anything wrong. However, sometimes fear or perhaps distrust of law enforcement leads to crimes not being reported. Keith Foster, public information officer for the Rogers Police Department, says in order for officers to do their job, they've got to be able to communicate effectively with citizens. To that end, the Rogers Police Department is hosting a public forum tomorrow night at the Metroplex Event Center for members of minority populations in Rogers. When I spoke with Foster late last week by phone, he explained that the department has been hosting these types of outreach events for some time now.
We've been doing this for about 2 years now, where we've been meeting with different minority community leaders. And we started about 2 years ago meeting with leaders, trying to discuss what are the problems, what are the concerns of the Hispanic-Latino community here in Rogers. The Hispanic-Latino community is about 30%, 30, 33%, so almost one-third of the entire population of Rogers is Hispanic and Hispanic or Latino. So that's a huge percentage of our population that historically doesn't have a great relationship with the police department. So what we want to do is try to start changing some of that, try to build trust, kind of get some of those inroads, you know, for trust going in like that. And kind of what brought this about was about 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, over the summer, we had had a whole bunch of home invasion burglaries. People were gone, you know, at work during the day. People would come in, kick the door in, steal stuff out of the house. And what we were finding is that while there were several incidents of it, people weren't reporting it to us like we needed it to be reported so that we could deal with the situation. So it started us thinking, hey, we've got to do something to start making some bridges, some inroads with the community so that they feel comfortable coming to the police to report when things happen to them or, you know, different crimes and stuff like that take place.
And you said historically there's sort of been a lack of trust with the minority community and the police department.
Right.
Why do you have a sense of why that is after having a couple of these forums? Is it just a matter of a language barrier or a cultural differences or?
Yeah, I don't think it's any one specific thing. I think it's probably a combination of several different things. I think historically, maybe even culturally, some of the countries where people may have immigrated from, law enforcement is not quite the same as law enforcement here, you know, in the United States. And so there's kind of a certain amount of, I don't know, distrust of police and how they are. Now, that's not saying all, you know, everyone is like that, but I think it comes to that. You know, there might be some other cultural differences. One of the big things we found was the whole, or some of the lack of, you know, people wanting to come talk to us, was the whole immigration issue. And at that time, we were participating in part of the 287G program, working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And so that, of course, created a large amount of distrust with the community members. And a whole lot of disinformation was spread about, you know, if you come and report something to the police, they're going to deport you. You know, that would never be the case. So, you know, what we found is that seemed to be the major sticking points. And for about a year of our meetings that we had with the various community leaders, that really seemed to be about, you know, the big point. Well, around I can't give you the exact date, but sometime earlier this year, that program has now gone away. So we don't participate in the 287G program. The federal government decided they don't want to continue with that program. So we have no immigration enforcement at the police department anymore. And part of what we found was after that went away, we started talking again, and we weren't getting a whole lot of concerns anymore. You know, it seemed like everything was all focused on the immigration issue. So what we're wanting to do now is kind of gear back, shift gears, and just start going directly to the community members and saying, hey, what are your concerns? What are the problems you might be having in the community? Do you have any concerns? Do you have any questions about the police, about law enforcement, what we do, how we do, why we do it, that kind of thing? You know, our whole goal is to, you know, make sure that the quality of life in Rogers is good for everyone. And so, you know, the only way we do that is by communication and dialogue with everybody to find out what the community concerns are. And so that's really the big driving force behind it is, you know, we're here to help everyone. We want to know what your concerns are. You know, do you have specific crime concerns in your community? Is it, you know, you're worried about speeders in your neighborhood where your children play? You're worried about, you know, drugs, you know, any number of things. But that's the kind of information that we're looking for.
So if I go to this meeting on Tuesday night, will it be mostly the police department giving a presentation, or is it mostly you standing there saying, okay, what are your questions, you know, go?
No, there's not a major agenda for it. You know, we may come in, we may talk a little bit. But for the most part, it's an open thing for people to come up and tell us your concerns. You know, what we're really looking for are specific things that we can do here in Rogers. You know, how can we make life better for people here in the city of Rogers? And now a lot of these same concerns could carry over into Springdale and Fayetteville and Bentonville and, you know, everywhere else in Northwest Arkansas. But like I said, because we're Rogers Police Department, we're primarily concerned with us. But it's the kind of things we want to know and the kind of stuff that, you know, what can we as a police department do to help make life better? There are some things that, you know, people are still concerned about. It's the Secure Communities Program. What it is anytime you're arrested and you go to jail, they run your fingerprints. Those fingerprints are then ran through a federal database to look to see if you've ever had any encounters with, you know, immigration or other law enforcement type agencies. And so I understand there's still, you know, some concerns about that. That's not anything that we have control over. That's a national program. It's a federal program. It's run through the sheriff's office. It's not anything that we can talk about. And we've had people come and, you know, address their concerns on that. And again, we try to tell them, you know, that's not what we can do. We're looking for what can we do here in Rogers to make your life better.
Keith Foster is the public information officer for the Rogers Police Department, and we spoke by phone late last week. The department is inviting members of minority populations in Rogers to attend a public forum tomorrow night to address quality of life issues. The forum is scheduled from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Metroplex Event Center, which is located at 2305 South 8th Street in Rogers. Participating representatives from the police department include Chief James Allen, Captain Hayes Minor, and Captain James Baker. Foster, along with Giovanni Sarmiento, Vice President of Minority Business Development at the Rogers Lowell Area Chamber of Commerce, will help facilitate the event. More information is available by calling 621-1172.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blues Show, where local and international artists get showcased for over 22 years. You know, anymore, the blues casts a wide net. As new generations emerge, the look and the sound of the blues continues to evolve. Tune in every Friday night at 9 o'clock to see what I've captured next on listener-supported KUAF. We'll see you then.
It is Monday, November 18th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Me too.
Good.
Thanks for not asking.
But you answered for me. So you have to.
It's just fun to give her grief when she's thinking about other things. So where are you going to be tonight?
I'm going to be at George's Majestic Lounge watching Joe Pug perform.
There you go.
Oh, was that the right answer?
Yes, that was the right answer.
It's actually where I'm going to be. My friend, for her birthday, we're taking her.
And I'm
going
to be in Eureka Springs watching B.B. King.
Excellent.
And both of those are on my list.
Okay, well, do tell about the people, so the people that don't know these things do know, so they can pick one.
Well, they tell me that B.B. King does not really perform that much anymore at one of his shows, that he talks a lot. But he's almost 90.
Is he that old?
Almost 90. So a chance to see him live is pretty amazing. He will perform with his band at 7:30 at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium. And tickets start at $95. Oh, no, $105 at day of the show.
Okay.
It's a pretty big deal.
Sure.
And you can call 253-2772. Joe Pug, who I know nothing about.
Okay.
But our music writer, Kevin Kinder, is going to tell you that he's one of the many folk artists who visited Fayetteville during the Fayetteville Roots Festival.
He was.
And he's from Chicago. And he will be back at George's, and tickets are just $10.
Yep.
There's a jazz concert tonight at 7:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith. It's the UAFS Jazz Band and Jazz Cats. Even cheaper, $8. Nope, that's Tuesday. I take that back. And also on Tuesday is a band called Genders.
Not familiar.
Kevin says they are a casual rock and roll band that they say makes their fans find a balance between shredding your clothes off and weeping softly in the corner.
Okay.
They're from Portland, and they will be at the Light Bulb Club at 9 o'clock on Tuesday. And the final ticket price, $5.
Perfect.
You can see a lot of music for not much or one great musician and spend your whole budget there.
Lots of options. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Kitchen. Nice. And then, of course, we always have to have storage because of all of our tents and stuff. So that's all out here. Tents and coolers and squeeze bottles.
Rhonda Fincher, executive director of Kendrick Fincher Hydration for Life, is giving a tour of the nonprofit's new office on Poplar Street in Rogers. The approximately 1,800-square-foot renovated home is located on the Center for Nonprofits at St. Mary's campus. For the past 8 years, Rhonda's organization used about 1,500 square feet of space in a shopping center, which is located about a two-minute drive south of the group's new home. Rhonda says they have been looking for more usable space in a better location. They inquired about renting their current office last year, but Rhonda says the price was too much. When the space was still available this year, she says they were able to work out a deal with the Center for Nonprofits so the rent for the new office wouldn't cost them more than the rent at their previous location. The new space has been remodeled for the organization through the help of volunteers.
The transformation of the inside of the house is, I think it just got that symbolism of the growth of the foundation almost. It's like everybody coming together and making it happen. Without the benefit of a staff, because we've never really had staff. We've really been a volunteer-driven organization, and yet we continue to make progress, we continue to grow, and we continue to, make a difference, but we do it with volunteers and people that are passionate about our cause and really want to help. So I look at this building, and I see it just as a symbolism, you know? And even these chairs we're sitting on, it was just very bizarre how I knew I needed two chairs for the office. And, we had used up what little budget we wanted to spend on stuff for the inside. And I'm like, well, they'll come from somewhere. And sure enough, I was at somebody's house and they're like, anybody need two chairs? I'm like, yeah, as a matter of fact. And so it's like, stuff just comes together.
The organization was founded after Rhonda's son, Kendrick, died from complications of heat stroke in the summer of 1995. The group's mission is to promote proper hydration and prevent heat illness through education and supporting activities. That mission, along with the organization's vision and new logo, are displayed on the walls of the new office's lobby. The past few months have been full of change for the organization. After moving into the new space in late September, a new logo was unveiled at the beginning of this month. The new logo still includes the runner with the water bottle that was prominent in the previous logo. The burgundy coloring has been replaced with blue hues, and the runner is now surrounded by a drop of water. The organization's name has also undergone some changes. Instead of the Kendrick Fincher Hydration Foundation, it's now Kendrick Fincher Hydration for Life. Executive Director Rhonda Fincher says these changes are to help better signify what it is the organization does. Several of these changes were a result of working with a Fayetteville-based web design and marketing company called White Spider.
We approached them about doing our website and then found out that we just could not afford them. And but they wanted to work with us. And as part of working with us, they suggested some changes in our colors, our logo, and they've just worked with us through the process. The thing that they requested is that we give them some freedom to be creative, and we did, but they have really honored our history and what we're looking for the future, and they've kind of pulled it all together for us so that it looks great.
Rhonda says White Spider has adopted Kendrick Fincher Hydration for Life as the company's charity of choice this year. In addition to helping with the process of rebranding, White Spider organized a bago and brisket benefit for the nonprofit.
They've been a great partner with us, and you know, they've really gotten involved with the organization, which is we love when the organizations that we work with, the people that support us, want to become involved in the mission because it benefits them and it benefits us. And White Spider is a great example of that because they've just kind of taken us under their wings and have used their expertise to help us and help us look to what we can do to help us grow. And one of the things they liked when they looked at our organization is that we are a local organization that has a national reach. And they are, same thing, they're a local organization, started in Fayetteville, but they have national growth. And so they saw a true partnership that could not only be in Northwest Arkansas, but also national.
Through the help of a retired school teacher, the organization is also working on creating a new educational program for school children.
For years, we always just went into the schools, did the presentation, but pretty much all of them were done by me. And Kim Mason now has come in, and she has designed curriculum that can be easily done by any teacher in any school, anywhere in the country. So right now we have the K-4 education curriculum completed, and it's in booklet so that the schools can actually purchase it. It's part of us helping create sustainable revenue. We had a grant that we got this year too from the Larson Foundation, and they paid for the development of the booklet and to help us get the booklet done and a DVD to accompany that. It's not often you can find funders that will fund, you know, making something pretty and the marketing of it. And that's what they provided to us so that we can help get some sustainable funding. So that was huge for us too, to get that.
Rhonda says they are now working on making the information more relatable for older children so they can develop a curriculum for middle school and high school students. Among the changes the organization has experienced recently, Rhonda says the change in the group's name exemplifies where they've been, who they are, and where they want to go.
We've always been hydration education for children and athletes, heat illness prevention for athletes, and we've made huge inroads in Northwest Arkansas and a lot in the state, and we just want to continue that education. There, you know, we were a grassroots organization, and changing the mindset of individuals to realize that, yeah, you kind of do have to educate people on proper hydration because nobody else is doing it. You know, the people that are marketing beverages have commercials on all the time. And in order to educate children on proper hydration, it's important that we continue to educate. So we want to continue what we're doing, which is basic. But we want to just continue to do it on a bigger scale and to reach more people. Our mission is very simple, and it's easily articulated in other parts of the country, too. It's just a matter of reaching them.
Next month, Kendrick Fincher Hydration for Life will host a holiday open house at its new office, which is located at 1113 West Poplar Street in Rogers. The event is scheduled from 3 to 6 p.m. December 3rd, and it will include punch, cookies, an opportunity to view the 2014 t-shirt finalist designs for the organization's annual youth run, and the chance to vote for your favorite. A ribbon cutting is scheduled for 4:30. More information is available at kendrickfincher.org. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Repetition plays a big part in music. Repeated chords or a catchy hook can turn an ordinary song into a global hit. Songs become hits or standards because we like to listen to them over and over. Lisa Margulis, a member of the University of Arkansas's Music Department faculty, has been researching music, the brain, and repetition for her book, On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. She recently came to KUAF to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about her book and the different ways repetition in music works.
Sometimes we don't even know how much we're replaying the songs we love until you look at that inalienable record on the iTunes track playlist. Sometimes a sobering sight.
Right, you write that so many of us will say, oh, we listen to all kinds of music, but most... It's like five or six albums really make up the majority of our listening time.
Yeah, I was ashamed when I first looked at my own track play statistics. It's a really good reality check.
So, but there are similarities going on between pieces of music or songs that repeat something and our desire to hear the same songs over and over.
Yeah, and even more than that, the way that we imagine music. So if I just ask you to think about a familiar tune, one thing that can happen is that it can get stuck in your head, right? And that happens pretty frequently. In fact, a recent study has suggested that over half of people had been having songs stuck in their head, you know, multiple times each day. It just seems really widely prevalent. And often when they get stuck, it's not like you're just thinking through the song, which, you know, might be in some cases pretty pleasant. It's that it's a bit of the song that keeps going through again and again as if stuck on a loop. And that's the part that's really maddening for some people. So it's not just the way we're listening to music, the way we're choosing to play songs again and again. It's not just the fact that music itself has lots of repetition going on within the piece already. It's also that if we happen to think about music a little bit, even our thoughts about it tend to be repetitive.
There's the term that's really been popular with music the last five or so decades, the hook, right? We're looking for a hook. Yeah. But there have been hook qualities almost as long as music's been made. I mean, if you hear the opening of Beethoven's Fifth, that's a massive hook, right?
In fact, it's interesting that, I mean, in the first place, it's interesting that music seems to be a cultural universal. That is, there's no known human culture that doesn't make music. It's even more interesting that repetition is an important part of music from all the cultures that we know about. So repetition in music is actually also a cultural universal. And whenever something is entrenched to that degree in so many different kinds of circumstances, it really starts you thinking that there might be something at the level of fundamental aspects of biology or psychology that might be relevant. So this is one of the first kind of observations that intrigued me and made me interested in writing this book. You know, it's you'd think, well, if repetition's such a big part of music, surely there's tons of work about this and we'll be able to understand it from all these aspects. But in fact, it's really been a profoundly neglected subject. I mean, you can go to the New Grove, which is kind of the place to go if you're looking for, you know, the basic encyclopedia of music that people go to, and look at the entry for repetition. And, you know, there's just a couple inches of text and some peripheral sources. And basically the upshot is we don't really know what's going on in this area.
Well, it's at once very familiar, but on the other hand, very mysterious.
That's exactly right. It's so, I think it's one of these things that's so pervasive, you almost forget that it's strange until you really take a look at it. I think another thing that repetitions had working against it as far as becoming an object of scholarly inquiry is that for the longest time, people who were studying music had to kind of prove that it was okay to be studying music. So, you know, they kind of always were trailing behind some other domain, like, oh, well, music is really a lot like language. So if it's okay to study language, it's probably okay to study music, you know. And repetition, almost this feature that was unique to music and kind of embarrassed people. Like, you know, people felt like repetition is maybe a little childish or regressive or maybe aligned with insanity. There's these tropes throughout history of people looking at repetition as somehow maybe crazy. I don't know. And so I think it took a lot for people to be able to confront repetition in music head on, acknowledge it, and start wondering why it is and how it works rather than just trying to sweep it under the table.
Well, so if you have something that hasn't been studied that much, where do you begin?
That's a great question. Yeah. Well, so basically, in the case of musical repetition, you have a lot of work that circles around it. It doesn't quite get into the grist of the matter, but it kind of rubs up again alongside it. So you can kind of start there. And then the big thing that really helped me was that we have a lot of new understanding about the psychology of repetition in other domains. So there's a lot of literature, for example, on the psychology of ritual, on disorders associated with repetitive behavior. So you could start by looking at all these different domains and then try to kind of draw them into the discourse about music.
One of the more interesting parts, and we've touched on a little bit already, one of the more interesting parts is what we call earworms.
Yeah.
Or I love the German word is stubborn music, yeah. Translates to stubborn music. And why something sticks with us.
Yeah, this is a topic that's just starting to get a lot of attention. In fact, I have an undergraduate who's writing her thesis about, she's trying to understand what kinds of situations tend to trigger earworms. So she's presenting music to people in a couple of different kind of contexts and then having them do kind of a mundane, unrelated task and trying to see which of those contexts can elicit earworms most successfully. But, yeah, and in fact, I've had the chance also to meet some people locally who suffer from, I mean, most of us have earworms that are annoying maybe and, you know, maybe sometimes funny. Mm-hmm. But it can actually, there's actually a really pathological version of earworms where you just constantly have music stuck in your head and you can't ever get it to stop. And that becomes a really different, more serious kind of situation.
Well, it comes to familiarity. And you point out that you could take a famous painting. Say you take Mona Lisa and you black out the upper fourth. Mm-hmm. You know what should be there. But I don't necessarily instantly put exactly what's going to be there. But you use the great example of that Muppet song. And if you hear the first part of it, the ma-na-na-na, everyone who just heard me do that, right, finished up.
Yeah, you're welcome, KUF listenership.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, part of what we're doing when we're listening to repetitive music is we're really invested in the thing that's about to happen next. As evidence of this, I just raised the example of my kids. We used to listen to the same CDs in the car, and they couldn't even enjoy the last 20 seconds of an individual song because they were like, oh, baby beluga's next. You know, they were so committed to the thing that was going to happen a few seconds down the road. And we really listen like that when we know music well. And what that's really about is you know, in a way, the music has started to play us, in a sense. So it has told us exactly the thing that is going to be coming inevitably out of the sound we're currently hearing. And it just puts us in this different kind of relationship to our acoustic environment. I mean, this is one of the things that separates musical attending from linguistic attending. So this example of the speech-to-song illusion, I think, is really strong evidence.
And what is, I mean, what are we hearing there?
Well, you know, first of all, you're just going to hear spoken utterance, and it's just going to sound like regular speech, because mm-hmm. that's what it is. And then you're going to hear a little bit of that repeated. And then when you go back and hear the original utterance, a really arresting transformation will have taken place. Not for everyone, but for about 85% of listeners.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible. Sometimes behave so strangely. The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
Did it happen for you?
It did. And there are some hip-hop artists who have deconstructed sounds like this and say they will put a loop on for a long time and hear, you know, for hours and hear something then that you wouldn't have heard otherwise.
That's exactly right. I mean, that seems to be one of the really basic things that repetition is doing, is that it's shifting your attention such that you're no longer approaching the music the way you naturally would. You're kind of tunneling into some trippy attribute of the sound or going up to some structural aspect. I mean, another great example of this is semantic satiation. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you know about this effect, where if I just repeat a word, so if I said radio.
You keep saying it. And then, at some point, it just becomes this sort of alien word.
Yeah, you think, wow, that A sound is so strange. And
I'll never think of that word the same.
Yeah, you can't. Generally, it's really hard to lose the semantic association of a word, to not hear the word radio and think of this station that we're sitting in or something, right? But that gets entirely suppressed, and you start thinking just about these low-level aspects of the sound. And that's a really great kind of process for music to capitalize on, because often what music wants you to do is listen to those very subtle aspects of the sound, and repetition is one way to drive your attention down to that level.
Well, let me ask you then about this place. I don't know if I'm going to get the pronunciation right. Basal ganglia?
Yeah.
That's in our brain.
Yeah.
What's happening up there? And why does this relate to music?
Right. Well, you can look at what happens when people indulge in repetitive behaviors. So let's take an example of something you might do every night. So maybe you brush your teeth. I guess I hope you brush your teeth. Often you don't really need to think about brushing your teeth, right? It all just happens rather automatically.
You get the toothpaste out of the tube on the brush. There you go.
Yeah, instead you're thinking about an interview you're going to do tomorrow or something, right? You're not really thinking expressly about the brushing. Well, what's happened is that you've really encoded this as an action sequence. And what that means is that you sort of have an entry point to this sequence, and then you have an exit point. And in between the entry point and the exit point, it just churns on out automatically without conscious intervention. And there's a link between the way that's represented and the way, say, a musical phrase is represented. So part of the reasons earworm has, have such traction is that you can't think of just a little bitty moment of a tune. It has to unfold itself all the way to the exit point, to the point of rest at the end of the phrase. So that's how it can kind of grip you in this way for a certain extent of time. It's because you can't just duck in and duck out and imagine a little bitty moment. You have to kind of play the tune all the way through. It's just chunked together in the way you represent it.
I get the feeling that researching repetition and researching music brings up as many questions as it does answers.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's, you know, it's kind of an exciting time for this kind of inquiry because we have so many more tools available to us in terms of cognitive psychology and neuroscience and so forth to really ask these questions about musical experience that were just not tractable before. Mm-hmm. One of my aims in the book is to get people thinking about these questions and hopefully spur further research.
Lisa Margulis is the author of the brand new book, On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind, and a member of the University of Arkansas Music Department. She recently came to KUAF to talk to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about her new book.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Arkansas your Jimmy McCracklin was born James David Walker on August 13, 1921, in Helena in Phillips County. He took the name McCracklin from his stepfather, Barry, who adopted him. A pianist, organist, and vocalist, and also an accomplished boxer, Jimmy McCracklin made his name as a songwriter as well as a performer over a period of more than a half century.
What kind of life would we have? Just in case we both.
McCracklin family moved to St. Louis, Missouri, where Jimmy took lessons from blues pianist Walter Davis. Jimmy McCracklin joined the U.S. Navy and later settled in coastal Richmond, California. There, at his sister-in-law's Club Savoy, McCracklin was part of the club's house band, backing national performers such as Charles Brown.
Well, I know you're off the suit and you, and I know you're off the cheek and two. You can do, you just walk. You just walk. Oh, you walk. Yes, you walk. Yeah, you walk. And that's the walk.
Jimmy McCracklin formed his own band, the Blues Blasters, in 1946 and kept the band name for decades. The year before, he cut his first single, and McCracklin would record for several local and regional labels in Los Angeles and Oakland, California for more than a decade. Over his long career, McCracklin recorded for an array of labels across the United States, from Mercury, Chess, Stax, and Imperial, down to lesser known such as Irma and Minute Records.
Well, I know you're off the old Mambo, and I know you're off the old Congo. But when you do the walk, you stand in close and don't step on your partner's toe. You just walk. Yeah, you walk. You walk. Yes, you walk. Oh, you walk. That's the walk.
In 1957 and 1958, Jimmy McCracklin's first national breakthrough came with his R&B and pop hit, The Walk, complete with an appearance on TV's American Bandstand. Soon, the Phillips County native came to embody the so-called West Coast blues style with its faster tempos and emphasis on keyboards, not unlike that simply of straight R&B. In 1962, Jimmy McCracklin released his first solo album.
Tramp.
What you call me?
Tramp.
Well, you
don't wear continental clothes or Stetson hats.
It makes me feel good to know one thing. I know I'm a lover.
Out of opinion, baby.
All right, mama was.
In 1967, Jimmy McCracklin's song Tramp, written for and with bluesman Lowell Fulson, became a hit duet for Otis Redding and Carla Thomas on Memphis, Tennessee's Stax label. McCracklin never recorded a version of his unique and most popular and lucrative songwriting credit. Tramp has been recorded by such names as Buddy Guy, ZZ Top, and Steve Miller, and sampled by Salt and Peppa, Slick Rick, EPMD, Prince, and De La Soul.
You know what, Otis? I don't care what you say, you're still a tramp.
What?
That's right. You haven't even got a fat bankroll in your pocket. You probably haven't even got 25 cents.
I got 6 Cadillac, 5 Lincoln, 4 Ford, 6 Mercury, 3 T-Birds, Mustang. Oh, I'm a lover.
Really by me.
My mama was.
Other Jimmy McCracklin songs, from The Walk, to The Drag, to The Wobble, to The Georgia Slop, Think, Just Got to Know, My Answer, Lie to Me, and Beyond, also caught on with other blues, rock, and R&B acts. Even as he came to be known and embraced, especially in Oakland, California, as a practitioner of the West Coast blues, the songs and music of Helena's Jimmy McCracklin continue to resonate far beyond the West Coast of the United States. Arkansas-er Jimmy McCracklin of Helena in Phillips County in East Arkansas died December 20, 2012 in San Pablo, California. Jimmy McCracklin was 91. Here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Jimmy McCracklin of Helena in Phillips County with his song, Think.
Just in case we both are wrong,
I could give up my woman, you could give up your man, but it don't make sense to take the chance
before we think.
What would we do later on? What kind of life would we have?
Just in case we both were wrong.
Arkansas-er Jimmy McCracklin of Helena in Phillips County with Think. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, we'll have an unusual music lesson with Keith Terry. He used to be a drummer. Now his instrument is his body. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Stay tuned to KUAF for today's Here and Now. It begins next after Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Siloam Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening. I hope your week is off to a great start, and hopefully this will help you out a little bit. We'll end the show today with some music by Joe Pug, who, again, is playing at George's Majestic Lounge tonight. If you'd like some more information, you can visit georgesmajesticlounge.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a happy Monday.